Support for this podcast comes from the Fletcher School of Global Affairs at Tufts University. To start your future as a global changemaker, you must have context across fields like international business, cybersecurity, energy policy, and more. Don't just study global affairs, shape them. Visit fletcher.tufts.edu. Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at mathworks.com.
From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. With his left hand on the Bible and right hand in the air, President George W. Bush was sworn into office again today by Chief Justice William Rehnquist. After his November election victory, the president said he had political capital and intended to spend it. On the steps of the Capitol today, he began to describe how. In a 21-minute inaugural address, President Bush laid out a fabulously ambitious vision of American might and will ending tyranny everywhere. It wasn't marching orders. You could write it off as big rhetoric, but it was big.
We are led by events and common sense to one conclusion. The survival of liberty in our land increasingly depends on the success of liberty in other lands. The best hope for peace in our world is the expansion of freedom in all the world. America's vital interests and our deepest beliefs are now one.
Tonight on Point, President Bush's inaugural address, setting the stage for the next 4 years and for the Bush legacy. We begin tonight in Washington, where John Harwood, national political editor for the Wall Street Journal, has been following the day's inaugural events. John Harwood, thanks for being with us tonight.
Glad to be here.
So what kind of reception to the president's remarks today are you hearing? Some very, very kind of grand rhetoric here. Are people saying, oh my gosh, or is this exactly what they expected?
I think there was a good bit of surprise at the speech, actually, because of the expansiveness of his vision, as you just described, for ending tyranny around the world. But in the end, it was a speech just like George Bush's first term, just like his campaign, one that tends to divide Americans rather starkly. This is a president who attracts fervent backing from members of his Republican Party, and does not from everybody else, sort of splits independents and gets very strong opposition from Democrats. And the same is going to be true of reaction to his vision internationally to some degree, but also at home, the part of the speech that got somewhat short shrift today.
I want to ask you about how the spectrum of Republicans responded to this speech, but let's hear a little bit more of it first. Here, where the president said that this great American mission to end tyranny everywhere would not necessarily be by force of arms.
So it is the policy of the United States to seek and support the growth of democratic movements and institutions in every nation and culture with the ultimate goal of ending tyranny in our world. This is not primarily the task of arms, though we will defend ourselves and our friends by force of arms when necessary. Freedom, by its nature, must be chosen and defended by citizens and sustained by the rule of law and the protection of minorities.
President Bush today. John Harwood, hear the president saying not necessarily by force of arms would this big vision be pursued. But as I listened and watched the television pan the crowd to Colin Powell and others, I couldn't help but think what a kind of straight-up repudiation of the Powell Doctrine, for example, that you don't go into anything anywhere without overwhelming force. Here the president's talking about taking on the world. What about within Republican ranks? This seems as quite far from the sort of realist Republican Brent Scowcroft kind of view of the world in camp.
No doubt about it. Colin Powell's not the only one, not by a long stretch. There are a group of Republicans in Washington who I was with the other evening who were talking about organizing some sort of a counterweight to the neoconservatives and their ambition to remake the world. Brent Scowcroft has been a very notable spokesman for that point of view. And on Capitol Hill, people like Chuck Hagel, Dick Lugar, the chairman of the Foreign Relations Committee, have also been concerned that the administration is acting too quickly, maybe without the sort of planning that's required. One thing you have to say about the president's vision today, though, Tom, is that the mission he described is somewhat elastic. We're going to have to see how it's applied. It could be viewed in part as simply calling out those regimes that fall short, or it could be something more ambitious.
Calling out or something more ambitious, the difference being?
Well, he said we are going to clarify what the intention of regimes are and how they react to those seeking democratic reforms.
Right.
That's an entirely different thing from attempting to use American force to effect a change or to aid, in an active sense, rebels in their attempt to change regimes that aren't very democratic. And you can look at regimes that are more or less friendly to the United States, Russia, Saudi Arabia, nations of that kind, as ones that, in theory, could be affected by this doctrine.
It was hard to hear it today and not hear a challenge, even to those relatively friendly, heavy-handed regimes. Yet the president said that he would not want to see the U.S. imposing its own style of government. Let's hear that.
America will not impose our own style of government on the unwilling. Our goal, instead, is to help others find their own voice, attain their own freedom, and make their own way. The great objective of ending tyranny is the concentrated work of generations. The difficulty of the task is no excuse for avoiding it. America's influence is not unlimited, but fortunately for the oppressed, America's influence is considerable, and we will use it confidently in freedom's cause.
John Harwood with the Wall Street Journal. Is this speech today a kind of confirmation that it is, once again, at the beginning of this Bush's second term, the neoconservatives who are driving the conceptual framework for this presidency?
Yes, although I think George W. Bush is not one for labels. I don't know whether if you asked him, he would call himself a neoconservative or not, but clearly he is somebody whose presidency was fundamentally changed by 9/11 and who has embraced that change. You know, he used to describe himself in the campaign as a war president. He clearly is that. And those of us who have been expecting a much greater domestic focus with the difficult things he's trying to do on Social Security, tax reform, cutting the budget deficit, that sort of thing, I think we're surprised by the extent of emphasis on the overseas mission. And one thing the president and his team have to wonder is, are they going to take the capital that he earned in this election and spend it all in one place, or do they have enough to go around for all the various goals the president's taken on?
And what about the notion of a wider campaign, potentially military campaign in the Middle East? Some debate about where the administration's headed on that this week. We heard Cy Hirsch earlier in the week on the show and elsewhere saying it's a big green light to roll right across the region, others saying no. The president today, if you had to read it just at face value, you'd say, whoa, this looks like a big permission slip.
Well, it does. Again, though, how he applies that is a question. There's no doubt that the U.S. military is overstretched right now, or let's not say overstretched, let's say stretched to the limit, having reserves and those called up extend their tours, and it's very difficult for the U.S. military to fulfill the mission it has right now on its plate. We heard from Tehran today after this speech that a prediction that George W. Bush would not be lunatic enough to take on, in a military sense, Iran. You know, we'll just have to see how they play it out.
And finally, John, what about outreach to the Democrats? There was a brief mention of the president playing a unifying role, but not much along that line. How do you think it will be interpreted on the other side of the aisle?
exactly that way. It was a passing reference. He talked about the U.S. responding with one heart to 9/11. He made a reference to bipartisan attempts to respond to disasters like the tsunami disaster. But look, this is not a president who, by his choice of priorities and by his governing style, is a warm and fuzzy, let's bring us all together, can't we all get along kind of president. He is a someone who sketches his goals very concretely in ways that that do polarize the country. So far, he has succeeded both politically and in his governance in getting those things through with narrow majorities. He's going to have to try to do that again.
Well, big, bold, new language today. John Harwood, thanks very much for being with us tonight.
My pleasure.
John Harwood, national political editor for The Wall Street Journal. He spoke with me from Washington. We're talking this hour about President Bush's inaugural address today and his vision for America's role in the world. What did you hear in the president's speech? Are you ready to take on the world for freedom with George W. Bush? Is liberty for all everywhere the only way to assure American liberty? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now from Washington is Alan Lichtman. He is a presidential historian and professor of history at American University. Alan Lichtman, good to have you. Welcome back to On Point.
Thank you so much.
Also with us from Stanford, California is Terry Moe. He is senior fellow at the Hoover Institution, professor of politics at Stanford University, and also a presidential scholar. Terry Moe, good evening and welcome.
Good evening. Glad to be with you.
Good to have you. And with us from Hanover, New Hampshire, On Point news analyst Jack Beatty, senior editor at the Atlantic Monthly magazine. Hello, Jack.
Hello, Tom. Hello to our guests.
So happy Inauguration Day, everybody. Alan Lichtman, what did you hear in the speech the president delivered at midday today?
As a historian, here's what struck me, that George Bush has made a remarkable passage. This is the candidate who campaigned in 2000 saying we should walk humbly in the world, saying we should not be telling other nations what to do. This was a president who, in his 2001 inauguration address, was still the compassionate conservative looking on the domestic scene. Obviously, after 9/11, he felt he had a new historic mission. You use the word neoconservative, and that is certainly accurate. But I would go deeper into history and say that President Bush has taken on the messianic mantle of Woodrow Wilson and Theodore Roosevelt, looking at our mission worldwide as spreading values of democracy and freedom and liberty. Let me quote from what Woodrow Wilson said in his second inaugural address. The tragic events of 30 months of vital turmoil have made us citizens of the world. There can be no turning back. Our own fortunes as a nation are involved, whether we would have it so or not. And he talks about promoting and remaining true to principles, not the principles of a province or a single continent, but of the entire world. This is very messianic and Wilsonian in its sweep. And I think, as your previous conversation pointed out, because it's scaffolding and because it can be interpreted in many ways, George Bush has written for himself a very large blank check in foreign policy, a blank check that could be used to continue America's presence in Iraq indefinitely, and that indeed could be used to move against regimes ranging from Syria to Iran, and even such friendly American states as Saudi Arabia, Pakistan, and Egypt, although I would be extremely surprised. For a president who once said we should be humble in the world, this is one of the most remarkable turnarounds in history and one of the most ringing assertions of a broad mandate for presidential foreign policy. There aren't even any enemies' names. He doesn't talk about Al-Qaeda.
It's bigger than all the particulars. Terry Moe, we just got a minute before the break, but do you see President George W. Bush taking on a messianic mantle in his inaugural address today?
Well, I think he's expressing those kinds of principles. I also think he's grown dramatically in his role as president. He's much more confident and self-assured. He speaks much more eloquently. This speech was beautifully written and delivered. I thought it was truly inspiring. But I also think that there's a great gap between the principles being expressed and what is likely to happen over his second term. I don't think he has a strong mandate. I think that there are serious constraints on what he can do on the world scene. I think it is just not true that we're going to be taking aggressive action to spread democracy and freedom throughout the world, because we're up to our necks in Iraq. There's only so much we can do. And at home, he has a majority in the House and the Senate, but the fact is that if he tries to do anything dramatic, whether in foreign policy or domestically, he's going to have a lot of opposition if people don't like what he's doing. So he's heavily constrained.
Terry Moe, Alan Lichtman, Jack Beatty, please stand by. We're talking tonight about the president's inaugural address today, the inaugural vision. Listeners, you can join us. What did you hear in the president's big speech today? Does he have room to act on it? We're at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about President George W. Bush's inaugural address today in Washington, the inaugural vision described there. My guest, Alan Lichtman from American University in Washington. Terry Moe joins us from the Hoover Institution at Stanford University in California. Jack Beatty is with us as well. You can join this conversation. Are you ready to take on the world for freedom with George W. Bush? Is liberty for all globally now the only way to ensure American liberty? And the president said America has lit a fire in the minds of men. What is that fire? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. The president challenged in his speech today those who might disagree with him.
Some I know have questioned the global appeal of liberty. Though this time in history, 4 decades defined by the swiftest advance of freedom ever seen, is an odd time for doubt. Americans of all people should never be surprised by the power of our ideals. Eventually, the call of freedom comes to every mind and every soul. We do not accept the existence of permanent tyranny because we do not accept the possibility of permanent slavery.
We're talking permanent tyranny, permanent slavery, big language in a big speech today in Washington. Jack Beatty, the Wall Street Journal saying today and lauding the fact that on their opinion page, the editorial page, that this is not a Nixonian kind of president looking for peace with honor. It is a Churchillian president looking for victory at all costs. Did you hear that? And how much more is there in the coffer to spend on that victory?
Well, that's the question. I did hear that. And, you know, there are two traditions in American foreign policy. Alan spoke of one of them, the Wilsonian one. And the other tradition, descended from George Kennan, Hans Morgenthau, Walter Lippmann, is realism. And I kept thinking of a concept of Lippmann's, solvency. By solvency, he meant the connection between a nation's means and its objectives, its power, the things it wanted to do in the world and the things that had, it had the power to do. And in that respect, I thought this was a sort of, Bush was advocating an insolvent foreign policy. I mean, if you defined power as the capacity to persuade your friends and overawe your enemies, look what's happened. We couldn't persuade many of our friends in Iraq. That was a failure of power. We have not overawed our enemies there, and we have not won the decent opinion of mankind, to quote Jefferson. According to a poll I just saw, 58% of people in the world, how they poll that, I don't know, think that the president's reelection is actually a threat to peace. So we simply don't have the power to, say, change regimes in other places by force, and we don't have the authority to. We don't have the what the Greeks called the hegemonia, the legitimacy, precisely because the Iraq War has so eroded our ideals and our power to persuade. And you know, what I'm terribly afraid of here, and I think it connects to what you said about Cy Hirsch, is what the neocons are thinking about is a kind of contra option, that they're thinking about starting insurrections and insurgencies in some of these countries, insurgencies that, like the Contras in Nicaragua, will probably practice terrorism. Now, wouldn't that be something if in the war against terrorism we wound up supporting insurgencies that used it?
We'll see. George Bush might call them freedom fighters. Terry Moe, Al Lichtman, I want to get your thoughts on that. Let's hear a little bit more from President Bush, where he spoke directly to that. He called out to what he called democratic reformers facing repression.
Today, America speaks anew to the peoples of the world. All who live in tyranny and hopelessness can know The United States will not ignore your oppression or excuse your oppressors. When you stand for your liberty, we will stand with you. Democratic reformers facing repression, prison, or exile can know. America sees you for who you are, the future leaders of your free country. The rulers of outlaw regimes can know that we still believe as Abraham Lincoln did. Those who deny freedom to others deserve it not for themselves, and under the rule of a just God, cannot long retain it.
George Bush today quoting Abraham Lincoln, and lots of somber faces in the crowd as the television cameras panned, taking this big language, this big vision on board. What do you think? 1-800-423-8255. Corey is calling from Beloit, Wisconsin. Hi, Corey. You're on the air.
Hi. I believe that traditionally, in my American government class that I just took last semester, we had talked about foreign policy, and traditionally since World War II, we had been what you call Holy Alliance foreign policy role, which basically takes a position that based off of the existing world powers, regardless of the types of government, whether they be tyranny, communism, or a democracy, you basically try to maintain those power structures so that there's no shift in order to secure security for your nation. But I believe that because of 9/11 and our recent involvement in Iraq, we have taken the Napoleonic role, which is defined by the belief that if you create other governments in other countries that are similar to your own, that, in effect, will secure world peace.
And do you support that, Corey? Does that look like the way to go to you?
My opinion, I guess I would throw that question back at you, but my opinion is that I believe that there are good elements in the Napoleonic role, but also in the Holy Alliance, and that there's weaknesses of both, that we can't totally take a role in the global community that will ignore tyrannies altogether and will just, for the fear of altering global powers, that will come back to fall on us.
Corey, we've got it, and thank you very much for your call. Alan Lichtman, how about it? The language is very sweeping, but if you look at the kind of ambition of it, it seems almost impossible. On the other hand, maybe President Bush has it right. Maybe in a globalized world, there is no choice but to look at every corner of that world. Maybe it is a small world after all, and you've got to be on top of it.
Well, one could say between the sweeping rhetoric and the grim reality here falls the shadow. Professor Moe pointed out some of the constraints that are obviously going to be operating on this president. And as Jack Beatty pointed out, there is a fundamental dialectic contradiction between the way the president has gone about nation building and building the kind of legitimacy and public support among ordinary people that is absolutely essential to working towards democracy. The president himself talked about supporting reformers, supporting those who are promoting democracy, yet unfortunately that's not the way the United States is seen. I'd also like to bring up one other point that hasn't been mentioned, and this is critical. What he says about the allies. He says, all the allies of the United States can know, we honor your friendship, we rely on your counsel, we depend on your help.
Right.
Friendship, counsel, help. Not partnership. Basically, what he is saying is, you can come along with us, but you are not going to have that veto, that control, or anything approaching an equal partnership. While this is a global vision, there is a fundamental nationalism, I call it engaged nationalism, at the root of all this, kind of a unilateral nationalism that's been very strong within conservative circles and the Republican Party for some time. This is not the United States marching in partnership with the democracies of the world.
Terry Moe, do you see a revolution in U.S. foreign policy being articulated here? I mean, there's already been articulation in term one, preemption and all the rest, but is this a ratcheting up?
Well, it sounds that way, but I actually don't think it is. I mean, I think he wanted to give an inspirational speech to emphasize the importance of spreading democracy and freedom throughout the world, and also to provide a different kind of justification for our invasion of Iraq, because the original justifications don't really hold up.
No WMDs, so that's gone.
That's right. So
I'm not sure this holds up either.
Well, but it is a bigger tent, well, Terry Moe.
Pardon?
But it is a bigger tent, as you say. He's sort of
doubled up
the ante.
The question is whether this is going to constitute a revolution for our future foreign policy, and I think the answer is no. The fact is, however much he emphasizes freedom, we are not going to do anything to undermine the government of Saudi Arabia or Egypt or Russia or Pakistan. So we can say that we support people who support democracy, but we are not going to undermine our allies.
Does that then make a mockery of the presidential pulpit there? I mean, it's such a bold speech. It would seem to say very forthrightly to all governments, including those, be on notice. If that's just for show, what are the consequences of that?
I think, as with all sort of general expressions of general principles, they're subject to different interpretations when the rubber meets the road. It's not necessarily clear that just because he believes in freedom, he is somehow committed to undermine the government of Saudi Arabia, and that's the way they will interpret it.
What do you think Brent Scowcroft and Colin Powell are thinking when they listen to the president's speech today, Terry Moe?
I think they're smart enough to know that this is not going to represent a fundamental change in foreign policy, and that reality is going to require that our country refrain from aggressive ventures in other parts of the world, that we somehow extract ourselves from Iraq, and that we find some way, actually, to go back to Colin Powell's ideas about working with our allies and working with them in the future to help spread democracy in less aggressive ways.
Jack Beatty, here's Terry Moe saying, you know, this is big language and it gives him cover in Iraq. It gives a new, very grand rationale for Iraq, but don't make too much of it. And yet there's always been this kind of zone of unknowability around George Bush's foreign policy. You might think, well, he wouldn't do that. He couldn't do that. And then he does. And the reporting this week, again, from Seymour Hersh saying not only could he, they're planning on it. Are we left with that kind of uncertainty tonight about whether this is a rhetorical flight or, you know, or a real compass reading?
Well, I'm heartened at the way Terry reads it, and what he says I think makes a lot of sense. That's what we do need to do to get back to the Colin Powell idea, because that's where our strength lies. But on the other side, what I'm a little afraid of is that the president, like many presidents, especially in their second term, is facing or feels he may be facing stalemate with his we haven't talked about the domestic agenda, but it's almost as ambitious. And already he's hearing leading Republican congressmen say, well, I don't know, maybe we need to raise taxes to take care of the Social Security problem and not necessarily go in the direction of private. When you get people like Bill Thomas even saying anything like that, he's getting a signal, I think, that this privatization may not really have much of a future on Capitol Hill. His really sweeping tax reform idea, flat tax, if that's what he wants, that just, as everyone points out, that creates tremendous, people who are going to be hurt and they're going to know it and they're going to fight it. So those two elements, which are huge changes, he may be facing stalemate there, and like many presidents feel, well, foreign policy, I can act there, I have freedom there, and that's where I'm going to leave my mark. And in a sense, he's tempted toward adventure by the domestic scene.
Or at least adventurous language.
Let's hope it's just language.
Well, we'll see. But he did talk again today about that ownership society that he's made part of his Social Security reforms that he likes to tie to the tax reforms. Let's hear that piece.
We will widen the ownership of homes and businesses, retirement savings, and health insurance, preparing our people for the challenges of life in a free society. By making every citizen an agent of his or her own destiny, we will give our fellow Americans greater freedom from want and fear and make our society more prosperous and just and equal.
Alan Lichtman, the domestic agenda or even rhetoric got backseat play today, and yet there it was again, the same pillars that the president's talked about behind his Social Security reform, the ownership society.
Absolutely. We'll make a couple of points about the foreign policy, and then I'll get to the ownership
mm-hmm.
society. Number one, this town that I live in, Washington, D.C., is littered with the bodies of those who underestimated the boldness of George W. Bush. It's not the Colin Powell and Brent Scowcroft mindset that's in control here. Two, there are a whole series of contradictions that cut through this new enunciated policy. Let me summarize three of them. The use of force versus the legitimacy we need to promote democracy. Secondly, as Professor Mo pointed out, a double standard between the Saudi Arabias of the world and the Syrias of the world. And number three, one that hasn't been discussed, which is that George Bush has been roundly criticized for violating principles of democracy and liberty with elements of the Patriot Act, with policies on torture, and may not be the most credible messenger for democracy around the world. Now, the domestic agenda is very important and shouldn't be underestimated because there are two critical things behind the ownership society. Number one is to break the link between individuals and the state. For decades, conservatives have believed that dependence upon the government or the state is what has kept liberals in power and what has kept ordinary people voting for them. Number two, by making ordinary people owners, it makes it then very, very difficult to launch any kind of attack on capitalism. If, in fact, unions are challenging the owners, you can come back and say, but you're the owners. This is your ownership society. We can't let these unions. Or if, you know, the attorney general like Elliot Spitzer is challenging corporate corruption. Well, it's your corporations now. So there's a whole shift in the relationship between ordinary individuals and corporate power that's also at stake here. A very good article by journalist Rick Perlstein goes into this in great depth.
Terry Moe, do you see this in foreign policy, on the domestic policy, this new America emerging after decades of Democratic Party control? Are we going to have a fundamentally different dynamic after four more years of George Bush and maybe more of the GOP?
Well, I've heard people talk about this, and I have to say that I don't think so. And although the Republicans have really surged here, you know, basically taking control since 1994 and continuing to increase their control, it's really impressive what they've been able to do. But my own view is that there's one big political force that's going to change all this, that is changing all this, and that's immigration. You know, the fact of the matter is that California now is firmly in the Democratic camp. All the electoral votes are going to go Democrat for the future, as far as we can see. Immigration is going to increase. The Democrats will do everything they can to make sure that immigration does increase. The Republicans have a hard time shutting it off because they have business constituents that want immigrants to continue coming in. Those immigrants disproportionately vote for Democrats. The Republicans may be able to close the gap, but they can't close it entirely. And this means that over time, another 10 years, 20 years, we're going to have a Democratic majority, and I just don't know what the Republicans can do about that. They're going to take over not just California, but Arizona, Texas,
Terry Moe, hold the thought.
New
we'll
Mexico,
come back to it.
Colorado.
We're going to take a short break. We're talking about President Bush's inaugural address today. You can join the conversation 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
I think he's a war criminal. I think that that he should be tried as a war criminal, and I just came down here to express my outrage.
The best show that money could buy, especially mine. I'm rich, everyone, just like you.
People are dying. The billionaires are here. The millionaires are here.
They're dying.
Enjoy the party. Party time. People are dying. People are dying. Soldiers are dying. Enjoy your champagne.
Hey, Bush, we know you. Your daddy was a killer, too.
Hey, Bush, we know you. Your daddy was a killer, too. Hey, Bush, we know you.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about the president's inaugural address today, the inaugural vision. We heard protesters today in Washington just before the break, and there were a surprising number of them, but President Bush was hearing none of it. He was at the podium on the Capitol steps talking about a fire in the minds of men.
By our efforts, we have lit a fire as well, a fire in the minds of men. It warms those who feel its power. It burns those who fight its progress. And one day, this untamed fire of freedom will reach the darkest corners of our world.
We're joined tonight by Terry Moe from the Hoover Institution at Stanford University, Alan Lichtman at American University, and our own Jack Beatty. You can join the conversation. Did the president's bold vision today sound attainable, necessary, messianic? And did you soar with the president's rhetoric or shrink away? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I want to keep track of what's going on in Washington tonight because there is a lot underway. We're joined right now from the Stars and Stripes Ball in Washington, D.C., by Holly Bailey, correspondent for Newsweek magazine. Holly, thanks for being with us tonight. What's going on there?
Thank you for having me. It's a party. This is sort of the best way I can describe it right now. It's essentially a prom, sort of, for President Bush's biggest supporters. I mean, everybody is out tonight in their tuxes and in their evening gowns, and, you know, they're having a great time.
A prom for President Bush. There's been a lot said about the many millions spent on the inauguration. Does it look deluxe?
Yeah.
Does it look luxurious?
There's such a controversy about that. I mean, this is, I guess the inaugural committee has raised about $40 million for the inaugural prize tag. It's come from some large donors. And it's paying for, you know, these lavish balls tonight, among other things. There's been some criticism saying, you know, that perhaps, you know, there shouldn't be such celebrations whenever we're still at war in Iraq and a lot of our, you know, military servicemen are not home. But, you know, the organizers say this is a historical tradition that they're, you know, paying heed to. So.
And Holly, how does it feel there? We've seen a lot today about the security, and it's been very obvious now you're in the party zone. Does it feel like a security zone as well?
Yes, it does, as a matter of fact. There's visible security here. And, you know, as just speaking as a reporter, traditionally we were allowed to sort of, you know, mingle with the guests, but now we have an escort. We are kept behind, you know, a velvet rope, if you will.
So even at the party, you're not out among the party goers?
Yeah, we have to have an escort, to take us to who we want to talk to. And, I mean, President Bush is actually due here to make remarks very shortly. So, you know, we're seeing some of the Secret Service sort of, you know, line the perimeter already. So, yeah, it's very high security.
Holly Bailey at the Stars and Stripes Ball, thanks very much for joining us for a few minutes tonight. And enjoy your evening. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks very much. Bye-bye.
Bye. We're keeping track of the inaugural festivities in Washington and also looking at President Bush's speech today. Alan Lichtman, we were hearing just before the break from Terry Moe that whatever the president may say, there's an immigration wave coming on that he sees as likely to support the Democratic Party in the years ahead. But we can feel the hunger for a real transition. Again, in the Wall Street Journal, the editorial page today, it's just all out saying, let's go, let's act. We haven't made as much as we should have of these last 10 years of Republican dominance of Capitol Hill. Let's really change the country now.
Absolutely right. Terry Moe is, of course, correct. Immigration does favor the Democrats. There's even talk sometime in the future, as he points out, of Texas, which doesn't have a single statewide elected Democratic official going Democratic, which is why I stressed previously this notion of the opportunity society is so critically important. Republicans believe that, yes, over the past decade, the winds have blown in their direction, but with immigration and other trends, those winds could dramatically blow the other way very, very soon. And I think they look at this second Bush administration as their last chance to make the mark they had hoped to make on domestic policy with Ronald Reagan, but didn't make. This opportunity society, as I explained, is absolutely critical for, number one, repealing, in essence, the contract between government and individual security established by the New Deal. And number two, giving ordinary individuals at least the idea that they have a stake in American business and in the American corporation, thus blunting the union movement, thus blunting criticisms of corporations, thus blunting corruption investigations, thus blunting regulations. And indeed, all of this is designed to weaken the link between these very minorities and the middle and working classes and their government as represented by liberals. It is bold, it is significant both substantively and politically, and indeed Republicans believe this is their chance. The iron is hot right now, and they've got to strike.
And today, all that wrapped up in liberty and freedom. Eric is calling from Cambridge, Massachusetts. Hi, Eric. You're on the air.
Hi. My name is Eric Waltman, and I'd like to comment on the word freedom, which Bush used 27 times. What does he mean by freedom? Is it freedom to be without health care? Is it freedom to be fired for wanting a union? Freedom to be even homeless? It's a nice word, but as Bush uses it, it's part of his extreme right-wing agenda to abandon social responsibility and promote rampant individualism. What about the freedom of want that I think Roosevelt had cited?
Eric, we've got it. Terry Moe, speak to that, if you would, the president's use of the word freedom, his meaning when he says freedom.
Well, I think freedom can be interpreted in many ways. But I think it's wrong to interpret some kind of far right-wing conspiracy here behind this as though we're going to turn the whole world into a free market. You know, I think what he's really talking about is people having freedom of speech, freedom of the press, freedom of religion, and people being able to vote for different parties and create their own governments. Very simple, basic kinds of freedoms that we can all agree upon.
But Alan Lichtman's suggesting, and our call is even more explicit, saying it's also freedom from the kind of government Americans have known in many dimensions for the last half century. Maybe that's the right thing for this new century, but is that not also implicit in some way in the ownership society?
Well, I'm not quite sure what you're saying. Freedom from what?
From government support. For example, I don't know where Social Security is going, but there's a lot of talk about individuals having more responsibility for their own retirement.
Well, I think if you're talking about domestic policy in the United States, then he may have a different notion of freedom in mind, which would be, to some extent, freedom from government control. You're right. And Democrats and Republicans have very different notions of what freedom means. However, we operate within a context in which we do have freedom of speech, press, religion, and in which we vote for government officials, right? We already have those basic freedoms. And I think when he talks about other countries, he's really talking about those basic freedoms.
For those countries, when he looks abroad.
Yes.
Tom is calling from Greenville, North Carolina. Hi, Tom. You're on the air.
Yes, sir. Thank you.
What are you thinking tonight, Tom? What'd you think of the speech?
I thought it was an excellent speech. I really appreciate the fact that he was reaching out across party lines. He mentioned the part about a fire in the heart of man, that fire of liberty. And I'm hoping those who have been his detractors the last several months will take the opportunity to reach across the party aisle in his direction as well.
You see him reaching out with that language about the fire in the heart of man, and it warms you. Tom, thanks for the call. Jack Beatty, you know, I, watching again the faces of the people in the audience today, they're spread before the Capitol. I saw them absorbing this as a serious speech, almost a serious challenge, because the vision was so big of going after tyranny everywhere. I don't know if the United States has ever taken on a goal of that scale before. This wasn't a wildly enthusiastic crowd in response, but it seemed a very focused crowd absorbing the kind of scale of what the president was at least rhetorically suggesting.
Yeah, I had that same impression that there was a that although the crowd was cold, and although the president kept alluding to fire, they didn't catch fire. And I think because they did connect with how sober the speech was, and also I think that I think that their sense of realism sort of stopped them, staunched their enthusiasm a bit. I mean, the president, you know, may not be true, but it's been reported that he says, I don't want to hear bad news about Iraq. Well, most people and most people in that audience just hear nothing but bad news.
But his suggestion today was that, look, there may be bad news, but this is a project of centuries, as he put it. So the bad news of a particular day, month, maybe even year, not such a big deal. It's a project of centuries.
It is a project of centuries. Ronald Reagan felt the same thing, but Reagan didn't feel that the United States had to itself militarily help to bring about this redemption of the world. He basically thought that who wouldn't want what America has? Just let the melting example of this country percolate across the Iron Curtain, and pretty soon that curtain's going to come down. And, you know, he also increased defense spending. But I think fundamentally he was right about that, that what we had, people wanted, and liberty was part of it. I think Mr. Bush is more fearful. I think he thinks that somehow we have to put arms around that. We have to, as it were, almost conquer the world to force it to be free, not understanding that we've got the thing that people do want, and we don't have to force it on them.
U.S. military clearly strapped at this moment, and very candid about saying so. There was a moment in the president's speech today that sounded almost like a recruiting appeal for young Americans to join the military, if you read between the lines.
I ask our youngest citizens to believe the evidence of your eyes. You have seen duty and allegiance in the determined faces of our soldiers. You have seen that life is fragile and evil is real and courage triumphs. Make the choice to serve in a cause larger than your wants, larger than yourself. And in your days, you will add not just to the wealth of our country, but to its character.
President Bush today. Brian is calling from Waseca, Wisconsin. Hi, Brian. You're on the air.
Good evening.
Good evening.
I heard the word freedom over and over in the speech, and I was concerned that the rest of the world kept hearing him say imperialism, and whether that is a justified to calling us imperialists is besides the point. The perception is there, and that's what is dooming our policy in the Middle East. If we don't stay there for 25 years indoctrinating secularism, everything will go to waste.
You're afraid that he says freedom and the world hears something else. Thanks for your call, Brian. Alan Lichtman, how about it? 1945, Franklin Roosevelt's inaugural. He said, of course, this was at the end, near the end of World War II, we have learned that we cannot live alone at peace, that our own well-being is dependent upon the well-being of other nations far away. Is that not a kind of echo of what President Bush said today, or do you see a further twist of the vision thing?
Well, as I said, Bush's echo goes all the way back to Woodrow Wilson, who I quoted. You could have put those statements of Woodrow Wilson right into Bush's speech. But, you know, with respect to the last caller, you know, there are two great traditions in terms of how to spread democracy throughout the world, and we've kind of been alluding to them. One is the vision that you do it with an active, aggressive policy, not force of arms as the first resort, but certainly force of arms as a meaningful resort, like we saw in Iraq. The other is kind of the city on the hill image. We are the beacon. We teach by example rather than teaching by activism and force. And I think so far our experiment in promoting democracy by force has largely backfired in terms of winning the hearts and minds of the world. And I do think much of the world sees Bush's declaration not as a universal promotion of freedom, but as an imposition of American values and priorities on the world, particularly, and I think Kerry Moe is absolutely right about this, if it doesn't extend to our so-called friends like Saudi Arabia, Egypt, and Pakistan.
Kerry Moe, we've just got half a minute left. Ronald Reagan talked a lot about the city on the hill. That didn't seem to be the tone of President George W. Bush today. It did seem more activist, more pushing out.
Yeah, I agree with that. But I agree with Alan that what we have actually done is to alienate people by trying to create democracies through invasion. And I think that basically doesn't work. But on the bright side, if we can say there is one,
yes, sir.
I actually think that this administration is going to learn from the Iraq experience being a debacle. And I think they'll be very careful about doing this in the future.
So big language, but learning haven't taken place. Well, we will all now see. Terry Moe, it's been great having you tonight. Thank you very much for joining us. Terry Moe, Senior Fellow at the Hoover Institution, Professor of Politics at Stanford University, and Alan Lichtman at American University. Thank you very much for joining us.
My pleasure.
Jack Beatty, always good to have you. Thanks for being with us tonight.
Thank you.
Listeners, you can continue this conversation online. Go to onpointradio.org, click on forums. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.